Thanks for showing up for the 5 o'clock session, last thing standing between you and dinner and drinks and whatever else you're doing. For the next 75 minutes, we want to talk about deploying Windows 10 and staying up to date once you get there, which is a big change from what we had done initially or had done with previous operating systems, which were all about setting up a big deployment project, getting to the OS, and then not worrying about it again for a period of years. Now we want to get into a situation where we can deploy Windows with new features 2 to 3 times per year, which really impacts the way you think about Windows deployment and Windows overall. We want to start off, though, just by talking about first some things that you can read through. If you get nothing else out of the session, please check out the links that we published a few weeks back that provide a lot of background information on a lot of what I'll go through here today, but also talking about Windows as a service, as a general topic, and also what it really takes to deploy Windows 10. So let's start digging in and start with just this general statistic, which always makes people laugh. There are only 1,526 more days of Windows 7 support, which sounds like a long time, and in fact, it is a long time. It's almost 5 years, not quite. But we started talking about Windows XP end of life with 1,000 days before its final demise, and still organizations didn't get it out of their environments in time. Now, there were a lot of reasons for that, a lot of which had to do with applications, not so much with just not thinking about it or getting around to it fast enough, but we're already hearing organizations like Gartner saying, you need to start planning for Windows 10 now. So start your planning, start thinking about Windows 10, even if you're not planning to deploy it within the next 6 months or in the next 9 months, at least have a plan, think about the time frame, and think about how you're going to be doing this. We also have a much more urgent task to talk about as well. Older versions of IE on Windows 7 go out of support, it's actually less than 63 days now. It was 63 days when the slides were put together, but we're within the last 2 months of support for IE 8, 9, and 10 on top of Windows 7. So there's the number one task. We need to get to IE 11 on Windows 7 by January 12, 2016, because after that, there are no more security updates for IE 11 for that Windows 7 operating system. That's rather urgent. If you haven't already begun the migration to IE 11, you better hurry up, because most people don't want to be running unpatched or unsecure browsers. So let's talk about that as step zero. The first step to get to Windows 10 is to get to IE 11. Not just because of that deadline, but also because IE 11 is included in Windows 10 pretty much unchanged. The exact same capabilities that are in IE 11 on Windows 7 are in Windows 10. That includes all the enterprise mode capabilities as well. So you want to learn about the enterprise mode capabilities that are there and take advantage of those to solve a lot of the IE challenges with older web applications on top of Windows 7, because that makes the migration to Windows 10 that much easier. There are a couple of extra features on Windows 10 related to enterprise mode, really just to deal with the situation where we have multiple browsers. We have Internet Explorer 11, but we also have Edge. So what we hope is that most organizations adopt Edge as the primary browser that's used for modern HTML5 standards-based websites, but then can leverage IE 11 for the older things that need these compatibility views, that need compatibility with IE 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, even back to IE 5. So we provide a mechanism within Edge to look at the enterprise mode configuration, and if a user tries to go to a website from Edge that isn't supported by Edge because maybe it contains ActiveX controls or uses Java or anything like that, it can redirect that web page to IE and have IE service that instead. So the two browsers can work together. You can use Edge for the modern stuff. you can also use IE for the legacy for compatibility. So those are the capabilities that we have there. We also have the Enterprise Site Discovery Toolkit. If you really want to know what sites people are using and how they're configured, especially around document modes, you can configure with the Enterprise Site Discovery Toolkit to have IE automatically write information about web pages into WMI, and then configure Config Manager or other software inventory tools to read that information into a central database. You may want to configure that to only capture information about your intranet, so internal websites, because you probably don't want to know some of the websites that people are visiting externally, but you do at least have that option to turn this on and collect an inventory of your internal sites to see the document mode that every page is being rendered in, and actually override those document modes on a site basis or on a per page basis. So you can make sure that the web page is rendered the way it was designed to be rendered using IE and all these document modes and compatibility capabilities that are present. So get to IE 11, leverage enterprise mode, which works really well. Be aware or be thankful that IE 11 continues to be in Windows 10 so that you can just pick up all those websites and continue to use them as is. There is a deployment guide around IE 11 that talks about all the enterprise mode capabilities, so check that one out. There's also a blog that the IE team published that talks about the support lifecycle and how and why they're dropping support for older versions of IE on Windows 7 and Windows 8 for that matter. So, assuming you get the IE issue behind you, that you're running IE 11 on top of Windows 7 and you're now able to make that jump to IE 11 on Windows 10, now we need to get ready for Windows 10, which is a kind of an infrastructure exercise. What do we need to do to our environments to make sure Windows 10 is ready, that we can drop Windows 10 in there and use it? Now, for the most part, you could just drop a Windows 10 client into your existing environment, and it would probably work. But the question is, does it work well? Do all the capabilities work as expected? Are you able to manage it and deploy it the way you would expect? So we need to look at the pieces of your infrastructure that are really tied into this. A lot of you are probably using System Center Configuration Manager. System Center Configuration Manager 2012 and 2012 R2 fully support Windows 10, but you do need to install the latest service pack. With Config Manager 2012, you need to install SP2. With Config Manager 2012 R2, you need to install SP1, and preferably the latest cumulative updates that go along with that, because that includes the necessary support for Windows 10. Anyone still running Config Manager 2007 and willing to admit it in public? One, two, three. Wow, there's quite a few of you in here. That is still supported as well to do management of Windows 10 with a hotfix that was released a few weeks ago. So you can continue using it. You just won't be able to use Config Manager 2007 to deploy Windows 10. Just like you couldn't use Config Manager 2007 to deploy Windows 8.1. So you can get there. You can use these existing Config Manager versions with the latest service packs applied or hotfixes applied, but you really want to look at Config Manager vNext, the release that's supposed to be out probably next month. What we've said is that it would be available in the fourth quarter of 2015. If you look at where we're at, we're running out of time in November, so by saying next month, I'm not really revealing anything. I'm just saying it's most likely next month. We will release this new version of Config Manager, but really design it so that it's Config Manager as a service. So think of it as infrastructure as a service to go along with Windows, which is Windows as a service, and even tie in Office and Office 365, which becomes productivity as a service. So all of these are linked together. With the vNext release of Config Manager, there's built-in support to do in-place upgrades to Windows 10. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. There's support for configuring and managing Windows 10 features. And most importantly, as we get deeper into the servicing conversation, you'll be able to use Config Manager to do kind of a staged deployment of new Windows 10 feature upgrades. MDT, if you're using MDT to create images or to deploy Windows 10, that's been updated as well. MDT 2013 Update 1 was initially released to support Windows 10 back in, I think, in the August timeframe. There were a variety of issues with it. Imagine that, bugs in Microsoft software. We fixed those bugs. We re-released MDT 2013 Update 1 a few weeks later to resolve those. So you can use that to create your images and to do light touch deployments as well. Included in that is a new upgrade task sequence as well. You can probably start to get a feel that upgrades are a major scenario that we want to provide support for with Windows 10 instead of doing the traditional wipe and load. So we've added a new task sequence for that. We did add support for doing split WIMs on media. So if you have an image that's greater than 4 gig, you can do that with media, even if it's formatted as FAT32, which is necessary for UEFI deployment. We've switched over to using DISM for deploying and capturing images, primarily because ImageX, which is what we were using before, is deprecated and is going to be removed at some point in the future. And a variety of other bug fixes were integrated into MDT at the same time. Combined with Config Manager vNext, we're also working on another update to MDT 2013. That should be out as a preview in the next couple of weeks, and then will be released probably a little bit after the Config Manager vNext release. The big thing with the new MDT release, again, is going to be bug fixes primarily, as well as ensuring that it works properly with Config Manager vNext and with the latest ADK tools that have been released as well. The whole discussion around Config Manager as a service and why you really need Config Manager to manage these new feature upgrades that we're going to be releasing 2 to 3 times per year has been described on the Config Manager blog. The team went into great detail as to why and the types of capabilities that they're adding to manage that. Basically, they're getting to a point where Config Manager can upgrade itself. Through the Config Manager console, you can see new components being released, and you just right-click on them and say install. So it's designed to really be able to more easily adapt to the new capabilities being added in Windows 10, so you don't have to constantly be deploying cumulative updates. You can just go into the console and say apply. It's a new operating system, Windows 10. Every new operating system we release generally has some new requirements around activation. We haven't changed the process of activation, but we do have new product keys. So you need to update your existing KMS servers to support those new product keys. There are hot fixes released for that, both for Server 2012 and above, as well as for Server 2008 R2. So you apply that hot fix, then apply the new product key to your KMS servers. That new product key then can be used to activate Windows 10 and all the operating systems that came out before it. There are actually 2 different KMS keys, one specifically for Windows 10. There's also one that's a big long description of Windows Server 2012 R2 Data Center Standard KMS for Windows 10. That's basically a server key. That server key gets installed on your server-based KMSs so that it can activate Windows 10 clients as well as all the current server OS releases as well. The fun thing with that one is finding it on the Volume License Servicing Center. It's fairly easy to find the Windows 10 KMS key. You go into VLSC, click on Downloads and Keys, look for Windows 10, it shows you the key. But for the server key, it's a little bit more work. You need to go under the licenses view to be able to see your active volume license agreement and then look at all the keys that are associated with that. It'll show up there. So it's a little bit more work to find, but once you found it, it's just a simple KMS key that you use to activate your existing KMS servers. You can also use Active Directory-based activation, no big deal there. Same basic process. You need to install the hotfix on the machine that you're using to do the Active Directory-based activation. You walk through the wizard, putting in the new KMS key, and that stores a blob in Active Directory that can be used to activate all domain join systems. So in that case, you don't even need KMS servers. You can activate them using AD. On the server side in general, there aren't any real strong dependencies between Windows 10 and server OS versions. Anything that's still supported from a server perspective should work with Windows 10 without any issues. That includes Active Directory and all the other components that build on top of Windows Server. But today, it's only Server 2008 R2 and above are still supported. The older versions have dropped out of support already. So we haven't done any testing with anything older than Server 2008 R2. Your mileage may vary, but what we expect is that any version of Server, any version of Active Directory should work fine. Now, if you did install the original Windows 10 release in your domain environment and you started seeing account lockout issues, there was a bug that dealt with some of the unlocking of machines and Kerberos and had to do with mixed cases of account names and those types of things. We did fix that with a hotfix that came out in October, so that problem should be gone. It really had nothing to do with compatibility per se. It was just a difference with the way account names were being passed from the Windows 10 clients to the back-end Windows Server Active Directory. So pretty much anything you have should be fine with Server and AD. But you may want to look at moving to at least Server 2012 or above, primarily for WSUS. If you're using WSUS standalone today, or if you're using Config Manager with a SUP, where the SUP is basically a WSUS server behind the scenes, you need to support the new version in Server 2012 or above in order to be able to deploy Windows 10 feature upgrades like they were updates. Behind the scenes, it's really doing an in-place upgrade, but you can do more of an update-type deployment. It just requires the new version of WSUS in order to do that. The version on Server 2008 R2 won't support that and won't be updated, primarily because Server 2008 R2 is in extended support, so we're not adding new features to that release. We will be coming out with a new server release sometime next year, so there will be some additional capabilities added in Server 2016 that have a nice better together story between Server 2016 and Windows 10, but none of those new capabilities are actually required to use Windows 10, so don't think that there's any real true dependency between those two releases. Group policies also become a concern. So obviously every new operating system release we come out with has new group policy settings. Windows 10 is no exception. The original Windows 10 release back in July had new group policies. The release that just came out last week has new group policies. So you'll need to update your group policy templates for your domain in order to set those new policies. The recommended way of doing that, so that you can just update the policies once and have all your administrative workstations pick up the core policies that you're using, is to set up a central store. How many of you are using a central store for group policy? Pretty good number. If you don't know what I'm talking about, there's a link to a KB that explains what is a central store and how to update it. I just walked through it this morning myself. It's not too bad to do. It's basically taking all the ADMX files and the ADML files, which are the language strings that go along with the ADMXs, and you put them onto your sysvol on your domain controller, so the group policy editor pulls them from that location rather than pulling them from the local machine. So that way you update them once, all the administrative machines pick up the new files, and then you can see all the new policies. So you can create that and then start setting Windows 10 policies. If you have existing GPOs, you may want to verify those to make sure you're not doing anything that first wouldn't work with Windows 10, especially if you're doing anything with security templates. Applying a security template from, say, Windows 7 on top of a Windows 10 machine is a pretty good way to break Windows 10. Especially with the universal Windows apps, anything that messes with the access control lists on say, C program files, has the potential to break a good portion of the Universal Windows platform. So be careful with existing GPOs. You may want to filter those out for Windows 10 initially, add them one at a time back on top of Windows 10, and just make sure that they don't cause any issues. Because Windows 10 changed the version number as well, from 6.3, which is what we were using with Windows 8.1, to 10.0, that actually can break some WMI filters as well. If you specify a WMI filter on a GPO that says if OS version is greater than, say, 6.1, Windows 10 isn't going to evaluate as greater than Windows 6.1. It's doing a string comparison of those version numbers, not a numeric comparison. So it's going to look at that and say, well, 1.0 is less than 6.1, so as a result, all of those filters are going to filter out all the GPOs for Windows 10 devices. That actually happened internally at Microsoft. We deployed our initial Windows 10 machines after we changed the version number from 6.4 to 10.0, and all of a sudden, we could log in seconds. All the GPOs were gone. Of course, we couldn't access the Wi-Fi network. We couldn't access any servers because we didn't have IPsec policies. Direct access stopped working. So they quickly fixed all of that to put all the policies back to get everything working again. But you do want to make sure that to check any WMI filters that you have in place. We've also updated the MDOP tools. Microsoft Desktop Optimization Pack. It's a set of add-ons for customers that have software assurance for Windows that add additional capabilities to manage Windows devices. Each of these have been updated with new service pack releases to support Windows 10, so you would want to deploy the new releases. In the case of AGPM, Advanced Group Policy Management, Service Pack 3 adds some new capabilities, primarily with PowerShell commandlets. App v5.1 is primarily a maintenance release, but it has some fixes to support Windows 10. Dart 10 has been updated to add support for the new version of Windows PE that came out with the ADK for Windows 10, since Dart is very specific to the version of the OS and Windows PE. MBAM, there is a 2.5 SP1 release that's come out to support BitLocker recovery keys. But you can actually continue using MBAM 2.5 if you want. None of the fixes in SP1 are actually required. And then we have UEV, User Experience Virtualization. A new service pack came out for that as well. So all of those were released in August. You may want to start deploying those service packs so that you're ready for Windows 10 regardless of when you start deploying it. If we look at some of the new enhancements in the case of AppV, it's primarily about making it easier to get from AppV 4.6 to AppV 5.1, so we've added some new features for that. We've also made some enhancements to make it easier to edit AppV packages, as well as to manage AppV overall. We've replaced the UI that we had before with an HTML5 web page for administering AppV, so it's a much more smooth management experience. We've also updated UEV to add compatibility with all the Windows 10 features, as well as to add support for roaming network printers from device to device, and a variety of other fixes as well. In the MBAM 2.5 SP1 case, it's just a variety of small enhancements to address feedback from customers, like being able to support E-drive, self-encrypting hard drives, things like that. So not a big release overall, which is why we say 2.5 is probably okay, but if you've asked for any of the features that have been added in 2.5 SP1, well, then obviously you may want to deploy it. So that's all about getting ready. We haven't actually said anything about deploying it yet. It's all about just getting your infrastructure prepared. Now we want to talk about deploying it. And we've been deploying Windows for years. We know how to do Windows deployment. Well, we want to change how we do the deployment. We want to move away from wipe and load deployments where we are using MDT or Config Manager to capture the user state, lay down a new image, inject the new set of drivers, reinstall all the applications, and then put all the data back where it came from. You can still do that with Windows 10, but that's a lot of work because you need to make sure you have all the drivers set up for every machine. You need to make sure you have all the applications packaged and available for reinstallation. So there's a lot of engineering effort that goes into getting ready for that type of a deployment. We think we can do it better, easier, faster, using an in-place upgrade. So we want to leverage in-place upgrade to let Windows do more of that work, automatically preserving all the data, settings, apps, and drivers from the existing operating system and migrate them forward into Windows 10. So really all we need to do for a Windows 7, Windows 8, or Windows 8.1 system is run setup.exe with a bunch of command line options to say that we want to do an automatic upgrade, and then just sit back and let Windows upgrade itself directly to Windows 10.
With the in-place upgrade, what sort of disk space requirement would you need?
So the question was, well, with in-place upgrade, what's the disk space requirement? It's right around 8 to 10 gig, because the upgrade process itself will take the old operating system and move it into Windows.old, a folder that it keeps on the hard drive just in case it needs to roll back. That folder will stick around for 30 days just in case some point after you've upgraded to Windows 10 successfully, if you decide, no, it's not working well, I want to go back to Windows 7 or Windows 8.1, you can go in and say roll back, and it will then leverage that folder to do the rollback to the old OS and put everything back to the way it was before you did the upgrade. So it sticks around for a while. You can manually clean it up with the disk cleanup wizard, but it will automatically clean itself up after 30 days. So there are some things to keep in mind when you're doing an in-place upgrade, though. The biggest of which is you can't use a custom image to do an in-place upgrade. You have to use the install.wim off of the original Windows media. You do that primarily because the upgrade is going to preserve all of the apps from the existing OS and then merge them into the new OS that's been applied from that install.wim. If you used a custom WIM as the basis for this, that custom WIM would probably contain new versions of applications. Upgrade has no idea how to take an old app and a new app and merge them together into something that would actually work. So if your new image had Office 2013, if your old image had Office 2003, after doing an upgrade, you would end up with both 2003 and 2013 on the same machine, and odds are it's not going to work at all. So as a result, we say use the install.wim, don't make any modifications to it. You could, if you wanted, inject the latest cumulative update so that it's a pre-patched Windows 10 OS, but you don't even have to do that. You can just use the install.wim directly off of the media to do this upgrade. We also have another scenario called provisioning, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, but the basic idea is we want to be able to use this for new devices, to take a new device and transform it into this configuration that you want to use for an enterprise device without wiping it. So what you probably do for new devices today is you either have the OEM put a brand new customized image onto the device for you in the factory, which costs a little bit of money most of the time, or you just ignore whatever image was shipped on that device, and as soon as you get it out of the box, you boot it up, you load a copy of Windows PE on it, and you do a bare metal deployment of a new image to that device. That's okay, but that's expensive. And it has limitations. We've talked with customers who want to provide their employees choice. They want to let them choose what kind of PC they should buy for their use at work. So they give them a budget. You can spend up to $2,000 on a PC. Pick what you want. Well, imagine trying to do that type of a scenario with a traditional wipe and load process. You could give them a list of supported models and say, buy any one of these, because you would already have the drivers and you would have validated and tested them. But if you really wanted to be able to tell them, go out to the local electronics store and buy whatever you want, there's no way to do that re-imaging the device. You can't possibly have the needed drivers to support every model of machine that they might buy from the local electronics shop or from some online location given the budget that they have to spend. So by leveraging provisioning, we want to be able to take what comes on the device and then just transform that device into something that can be used. That could involve changing the SKU of Windows, say from Pro to Enterprise, adding additional software, joining it into a domain, enrolling it in a management tool, and really getting it to the point where they can sign in and be productive with it. So let's talk about a few of these in more detail. First, in-place upgrade. The biggest problem we had in the past with in-place upgrade, we only supported N-1 OS releases. People routinely skipped OS releases, so as a result, you could never use an in-place upgrade to go from what you're currently running to where you wanted to go. We fixed that with Windows 10. Now we support Windows 7, Windows 8, and Windows 8.1. We can upgrade directly to Windows 10. We know that we want to make this as easy as possible, especially for consumers. So for consumers, we'll make these upgrades available directly from Windows Update. Probably a lot of you have already done that type of an upgrade to take advantage of the free Windows 10 upgrade offer for the first year, where it just shows up in the Windows Update control panel as something you can install. You click the install button, and an hour later, you're running the new OS. But we know most enterprises don't want that type of a deployment, so we'll support doing config manager deployments with task sequences, MDT deployments with task sequences, or any other software distribution tool. As long as it can run setup.exe with the necessary command line switches, any tool can do this type of an upgrade deployment. Again, we mentioned already using the standard Windows 10 image. Don't try to use a custom one. Will automatically preserve everything and install the new OS. We've spent a lot of time optimizing the performance of this. We wanted to make this as fast as possible. The range of time depends on a lot of factors, especially the hard drive speed and whether you're pulling the content across the network or locally. So it can take anywhere from, say, 30 to 90 minutes for most devices, which is comparable probably to what you're doing with the wipe and load, but it requires a lot less preparation. So that's where the savings are coming from, not from the execution time, which is going to be fairly close to a wipe and load, but just from the simplicity of it. Now, there are scenarios where this just doesn't work. You can't use this if you're going to change from Windows x86 to Windows x64. So it's not for every scenario, but hopefully for the bulk of the machines in your environment, you can use this to migrate from your existing OS to Windows 10 with minimal effort. We did this in a broad scale for those that deployed Windows 8 initially, because we released Windows 8.1 fairly quickly after the original Windows 8 release. So doing another wipe and load deployment that quickly wasn't very popular with the customers, so they did an in-place upgrade. That worked okay. We've made improvements since then to make it more reliable and faster, based on the feedback that we got from those customers. We also tried with a few customers to do this from Windows 7. So we provided a hotfix to customers on Windows 7 and let them upgrade directly from Windows 7 to Windows 8.1, just to see what would happen. And used the feedback from that to set requirements for Windows 10 to say, these are the things that we need to improve. All of those improvements were then baked into Windows 10 to make sure that no one else had to deal with those types of problems. We also discovered as part of that exercise that there are third-party disk encryption tools out there. Oh, big surprise. And those third-party disk encryption tools don't work well with in-place upgrades. So at the time, we started working with the ISVs for those tools so that they could provide instructions on how to hook their software into the upgrade process to let you still do an in-place upgrade while not having to decrypt the disk first. It works automatically with BitLocker, so you don't have to worry about that at all with BitLocker, but for tools like McAfee's disk encryption software, They've provided a white paper that says here's how to hook it into the setup process so that you can still use an in-place upgrade even with the disk encrypted with the McAfee software. If we look at the process that we use to do this, we would typically use a task sequence. Not because we have to, the task sequences are fairly simple, but it gives us the flexibility to do some things before the upgrade, then do the upgrade, then do some things after. Like maybe we want to turn off antivirus software or uninstall antivirus software, then do the upgrade, and then install the latest version of the antivirus software afterwards. So you have the flexibility with the task sequence to do those types of tweaks. We support that with Config Manager vNext, it's built in. We support that with MDT 2013 Update 1, it's built in. We also publish an example of how to do the same thing with Config Manager 2012 and 2012 R2, because with that you need to do a few extra steps with PowerShell scripts to enable that. There's a question over here. Yeah, so the question was whether you could add, say, a manufacturer's driver package into one of the post steps. You could certainly do that if the manufacturer provides an installer that you need to run. But we've also provided support which will leverage in Config Manager vNext and MDT for that matter, where you can, there's a command line switch for setup to tell it to install drivers contained in this folder. So you can set up the task sequence to download a set of drivers specific for this model of machines, hand them to setup, and say automatically consider these drivers during the upgrade process. So it's not just about leveraging the drivers that are included in the Windows 10 WIM. It also provides the ability to specify another folder as well. So you do have the option of doing that. We've been doing some testing with that, and there are a few types of drivers that we don't migrate forward because those types of drivers actually cause more problems than they solve. So for some, it would be better to be providing new drivers as well. So I mentioned that you can't use in-place upgrade to go from x86 to x64. In that case, you need to do a wipe and load. But there are other scenarios where you can't use it either. You can't use it with a Windows to Go stick. You can't upgrade Windows to Go. You have to build a new one. Same with boot from VHD. If you set up a machine to boot from a VHD file, not in a virtual machine, but on a physical machine so that you could have multiple side-by-side OSs, well, then you'd have to set up a new OS alongside the existing one. You can't upgrade. You can't change from BIOS to UEFI as part of an in-place upgrade. If you built a machine that's capable of UEFI, capable of secure boot, say a Windows 8 logo certified machine, if you deployed that using a legacy compatibility BIOS mode with Windows 7 and then upgrade it to Windows 10, it's still going to use that legacy BIOS compatibility. There's no real problem with doing that. It's just that you wouldn't be able to leverage the secure boot capabilities with Windows 10. There have been a lot of questions from customers who said, well, can I make this process work? Can I change the machine from BIOS to UEFI and upgrade to Windows 10 all as part of the same process? Well, maybe if you tried hard enough, but that involves changing the firmware settings, changing the disk partitioning, and upgrading to a new OS all as part of one process, and it's really hard to do. So it's not something we attempt as part of an in-place upgrade. It may be something that you could achieve with a wipe and load, where you capture the user data off of the machine to a network location, pave the machine to reformat and repartition it, change the firmware settings using a vendor-provided utility, install the new OS, which would now be leveraging native UEFI, and then pull the data back down from the network. So it could be orchestrated like that. It's just not something that an in-place upgrade is going to take care of for you. If you have machines set up for dual boot or multi-boot, it might work. It's not something we test, so use at your own risk. Worst case, it's probably going to upgrade the existing operating system just fine. There's just no guarantee that it will still enable you to boot into the other operating systems, because the upgrade process will likely replace the bootloader that you were using for whatever menuing system you have with those dual boot systems. So you may need to do some manual steps to fix that backup afterwards. That one's up to you to try out. We've also talked with a lot of customers who said, hey, I've got this great Windows 7 image. It's got all my software in it. Can I upgrade it to Windows 10, sysprep it, and then deploy it? No, you can't do that. You can't sysprep an upgraded OS. Sysprep will fail. It will tell you that you're trying to sysprep an upgraded OS. So you need to build a new image starting from the original Windows 10 media, do all your customizations that you want, sysprep it, capture it, and deploy that. We already talked about third-party disk encryption. The last one is kind of a fuzzy one, because it depends. If you're going to do an in-place upgrade and leave all the existing software versions in place, great, in-place upgrade will do that automatically. If you want to change the versions of antivirus software and the version of Office and the new version of Adobe Reader and all these other software packages installed on the machines, if you want to upgrade all of that at the same time, you're going to spend probably more time uninstalling software, doing the upgrade, and then installing new versions than it would to just wipe the machine, reinstall the software, put all the user data back. So if you're going to be making any wholesale changes in your environment, traditional wipe and load deployment may be a better approach. But if you're going to leave the existing software versions in place, then in-place upgrade works pretty well. So let's look at some of these pieces in-place upgrade-wise. So let's start off with the client view of things. First, from a Windows 7 client using the Configuration Manager agent. So this is a Config Manager managed machine. It has a couple of task sequences advertised to it. The first one does a traditional wipe and load. The second one does an in-place upgrade. There's really not that much that you would see different. As if you're the end user, you might not quite see the difference between them, but they're significantly different in the actual execution. So we'll choose the upgrade one and click on install. Yes, we want to upgrade our operating system. Oh, and it's telling me that the content isn't available. So we might not get very far with this one. We'll try it one more time. Yeah, my Config Manager server this morning decided that the version of SQL that it was running on expired. So I needed to upgrade it this morning and rebuild it. So I think all the content's still being distributed. So we'll skip over that one for now. Let me go over to another client machine and do this via MDT, which is always about running a script. Requires typing correctly. This just isn't my day. Deployment share scripts, lighttouch.vbs. Oh, yes. Let me go fix that. It's one of those bugs that we're still working on with MDT. It tightens down the security on the deployment chair just a tad too much.
because that's a best practice. Let's grant everyone read access. Okay, we'll let it think about that for a minute. Back to my client machine. That's a little better. So we can choose in MDT an upgrade task sequence. That does a few preparation steps and then just kicks off setup.exe with the necessary options to do that. So we'll choose Windows 10 Enterprise x64 upgrade 1511. 1511 is the most recent feature upgrade that we came out with, where 1511 is the year and the month. So it's just a convenient way of telling it apart from the original July release. We can tell it that we want to keep the existing information, so I'll take all the current defaults and kick off the process. So it will go through a few preparation steps, but pretty quickly it will get to the step that actually performs the upgrade. Except I think I chose the wrong task sequence. Oh, that's another error that we have fixed in the new USMT. Why didn't someone tell me I chose the wrong task sequence? Let's try this again. First, let me make sure I did the right thing on the server. Ah, I got them backwards. Yeah, that's not a good thing to do. The upgrade one. Is this one? One more time. Let's choose that upgrade one. So now it will quickly get to setup.exe. As soon as it actually pops up.
It was an error on the shell when we went to the machine.
Yeah, I saw that error. That one's kind of harmless, so I'm not too worried about that one right now. So the task sequence will go through, it will copy a few files down to the machine that setup uses to resume the task sequence after the upgrade completes. It will do a little bit of preparation work, and then it kicks off setup.exe. So right now it's running the upgrade OS step, and we suppress the UI, so as a result all you see is the task sequence UI. But if we look under in the task manager, we can see behind the scenes that it's running setup.exe, setup.host.exe, setup.prep.exe. So that's the stack of processes that are actually performing the upgrade. It will go through the steps required in the existing operating system to lay down the new OS and get ready to reboot into PE. Then it reboots into Windows PE as a temporary boot environment, puts the new OS in its final resting place, then migrates the existing configuration, including apps, data, and settings, into that new OS, and then finally boots into that new OS to get it up and running. So that process would continue for another half hour or so. While that's running, let's look on the server side at these task sequences, one on the MDT side. It's a fairly simple, short task sequence, just does some simple checks up front. then initiates the upgrade itself. If you needed to do any post-processing, you could install applications, enable BitLocker, do whatever other configuration you wanted. In the off chance that it fails, there's some rollback handling as well, just so that the task sequence can report that failure back to you. If we look at the upgrade windows, in the case of MDT 2013 Update 1, it's all hidden behind the scenes. So if you wanted to actually see the switches that it's running, you would have to dig into the LTI apply script. It's trying to hide that from you. How do you set the... That's a good question. In the config manager case, there's a task sequence variable where you can specify OSD additional OS upgrade options or something like that. I think the same thing's been implemented in MDT. I just haven't actually tried it. The only option that's exposed through MDT directly is the one that you can see on the screen, this dynamic update, dynamically update Windows setup with Windows update. Basically what that does is it causes setup to go out to the internet and pull down three things. It'll pull down the latest cumulative update for Windows 10, which is fairly sizable, so it's going to download that chunk. It's actually going to apply that to the install.wim. So it would copy the install.wim locally to the machine, mount it, apply the update to it, commit the changes, and then start the in-place upgrade. So that's a fairly time-consuming process. That's why it's off by default. You could manually do that ahead of time to inject the latest installed, the latest cumulative update into the WIM before the upgrade, but if you still enable a dynamic update, it's not going to realize you did that, and it's going to repeat the process. So that's the first thing it does. It also downloads the latest compatibility database so that it knows about any blocking applications that would prevent upgrade from succeeding. So it checks that, and it also downloads the latest drivers from Windows Update. So there are advantages to using dynamic update. The disadvantage is, one, it adds time to the overall process, and it has the potential to, well, apart from time, it's also it's generating a lot of network traffic. We're still working on the ability of getting that content into WSUS so that you can still use dynamic update but have it pull the things it needs from the WSUS server. That's not yet in place. So the question was, well, what's the difference between dynamic update and just enabling the Windows update task? It's the other two things. In the case of dynamic update, it's apply the latest cumulative update, download the latest compatibility details, and pull down drivers. The Windows update task will just pull cumulative updates. It won't touch drivers, and it won't update the compatibility details. In fact, it would be too late to deal with those compatibility details. I think there was another question over here. Yeah, the question was around pre-checks, where you wanted to basically do kind of a dry run and see is the upgrade going to succeed or not. There is a command line switch to do the compat check scan only. There is a blog that I had posted that explains how to do that. With Config Manager vNext, they were working on adding that directly into the UI. I'm not sure if they've done that yet. In the MDT case, you would need to build a manual command line to kick that off. Or if they've added the variable support, add that to the variable. The basic idea behind that is you can run setup.exe with a command line switch that tells it to go through the motions of an upgrade, but not actually perform the upgrade, and then report back a return code that indicates whether the machine can be upgraded successfully or not. If it can't be, it'll tell you why. It can't be upgraded because there's insufficient disk space, because there's an incompatible application installed, that there's incompatible firmware. There's a variety of different issues that it reports back as being fatal that would prevent the upgrade from succeeding. In the config manager case, I have config manager vnext installed here. If we look at the task sequence that it creates, it's even shorter. So we can check for readiness, which is basically a CPU processor disk space check. We can perform the upgrade, but now it does provide some additional options here, like perform Windows setup compatibility scan without starting upgrade. So they did get that one implemented. Ignore dismissible compatibility warnings, so there may be some things that it detects that you're saying, that's okay, go ahead and upgrade anyway. And then there are options around dynamic update as well, including don't go to WSUS because it won't work. Go ahead and try to pull them directly from Windows Update anyway. You can also specify additional drivers that you want to pull down. It will bring those drivers to the local machine and then add the command line switch to import those drivers, to have setup take care of importing those drivers during the upgrade. So if we were to watch this process go through in the case of a config manager task sequence, we basically start off in Windows 7. We kick off the task sequence, which is the part that I couldn't get to work because my content's not on the DP yet. After a while, it will reboot into Windows PE, where you see a circular wheel that's used to show you the progress along the way. At the bottom, it shows you the different phases of the process as well. The setting up phase actually is running in Windows PE. The applying PC settings and setting up a few more things happen in the new operating system. So all of the setting up is about putting the new OS in place. Then it will actually reboot into that new OS and start migrating everything from the old OS, using the new OS to do it. After that finishes, it will do a final reboot so that it's joined to the domain and everything else is in place. And then it will just do a few final tweaks before the machine then can be used. So when the process completes, you get to a Windows 10 screen that looks pretty much exactly like the Windows 7 system you started from, with the same desktop background, the same pinned icons, same desktop shortcuts, and even the same start menu configuration.
If I build a custom base image, can I apply 1511 on that and will it sysprep? Or?
Yeah, so the question was, well, if I build a custom image, can I apply 1511? No, you can't, because 1511 is a new set of media. It's not a patch. It's a new OS release. So the process of going from 1507, the original July release, to 1511 is an in-place upgrade, which is a pretty good transition after we get through the provisioning piece. But the basic idea is that first you need to get from Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1 to Windows 10. That's one process. And then after that, you need to stay up to date with Windows 10. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. From a provisioning perspective, this goes back to the idea of taking a new device and configuring it. So with this, we want to take that new device and transform it. And we've actually got a couple of scenarios related to that. One is very easy. Well, at least from the end user perspective, it's very easy. This from the cloud scenario where we just take a company-owned device, type in our ID and password, and have the rest happen for us. It will join the device into Azure Active Directory. It will enroll the device in an MDM service like Windows Intune, and then everything else gets pushed down to the device. So there's no IT interaction needed. All you do is set up the policies in Intune, set up Azure Active Directory and the MDM enrollment through Azure AD, and the rest just happens. That's one side. We can also do an IT-driven process where you build up a provisioning package, which is kind of a self-contained bundle of MDM settings, as well as software and other things that need to be applied to the device. You use the Windows Imaging and Configuration Designer to do that, bundle all that stuff together, and then figure out how you're going to get that out to the machine. Maybe that's emailing it to the person and saying, double-click here. There are also options to insert a USB key during the machine's initial startup. So there are ways that you can deploy that, but it's not like an automated process to get that provisioning package out to the machine. You could embed it in an image and have it automatically processed by Windows at the first boot, But that kind of goes against the scenario, which is go out to the store, buy a new PC and provision it. So that's why we look at these tools as being something more for smaller businesses who don't want an MDM service or don't have any type of management tools available. And it's just it's a clunkier scenario to go through. So let's look at a couple of those scenarios too, and let me switch back over to my laptop. Let's start off with the from the cloud scenario. So if we have a machine that boots up for the first time, it gets into Ubi, which for most of you, you never see these screens because you suppress them using an unattend.xml. But for a brand new retail machine, the first time it starts up, it will go through a few screens before this, but the initial screens just let you choose the keyboard, locale, and language. The next screen lets you accept the license terms, and then you get to here. So you can specify that this is a machine that you want to join into Azure AD, and it tells you use your Office 365 or your work account to do that. And the next step, it will ask you for your ID and password. Let's hope my machine actually has an internet connection here. It does, so I can put in my account and password. Assuming I got my password right, it will do two things. It will enroll the device, it will join the device into Azure Active Directory, and it will enroll the device into MDM, Intune in this case. So we've configured in Azure Active Directory, here's the MDM service that we want you to automatically enroll in as part of the Azure AD join process. So through just typing in my ID and password, I get access to company resources, I get single sign-on to cloud resources, and I get an MDM enrollment that can then push the rest of the configuration down to the device. So that's the dynamic process. If we wait for a little while, it'll come back and then sign us into Windows and install apps and all that other stuff. So we'll let that one run. Let's compare that against the provisioning package approach, which kind of starts off from the same place. We have a machine, it boots up for the first time. This is the first screen in the Ubi process where you choose all of the different settings for the OS. If we hit the Windows key 5 times on this screen, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it pops up with a dialog that says, would you like to configure this device? Yes, I would. If I say to set up at this point, it will then look at all the removable drives on the system and show them to me and allow me to pick a provisioning package off of one of them. Now, this is a virtual machine. Can you guess what type of removable drive is supported on a virtual machine? A floppy. So I've actually put my provisioning package on a virtual floppy so that I can select it here. So obviously, it's not a very big provisioning package. I don't have any apps or anything else like that in it, but we can choose the provisioning package and have it applied right at this point in time. That can change the SKU of Windows from, say, Pro to Enterprise. That can do all kinds of stuff to the machine. It will pop up with a message and tell you these are the types of things that it's going to do. I'll say yes, go ahead and add it, and that begins the provisioning process. So if you wanted a simple way to set up a device to transform it into an enterprise device, that's not too bad, but it's not necessarily something that an end user sitting in a remote office that they just bought a machine from the local electronics shop, they're not necessarily going to be able to do that. But the first scenario where they just type in their ID and password, that one's easy. So we'll let that run for a while. In the meantime, let's briefly look on my site server here at the Windows Imaging and Configuration Designer tool. That's the tool that's used to author a provisioning package. So it shows you all the settings that are available, and it lets you actually then pick which one. Pick which ones you want to configure. So I could say that I want to create a new provisioning package, give it a name, doesn't really matter what the name is, say what editions of Windows, because it's not just for desktops, it can also be used for phones and IoT devices. I can import a base package if I wanted to start from something else, and then it'll show me all the configuration that I can make. Most of what we would want to do is runtime settings, so we'll expand out the runtime settings and we can see all kinds of stuff where we can configure some things with the browser, we can add certificates, we can create VPN connections, we can say to automate UBI. We can even specify that we want to do an edition upgrade with a product key and then just put in a product key for, say, Windows 10 Enterprise. So if you're wondering, well, what's the product key for Windows 10 Enterprise? Just put in the setup key. If you go out to TechNet and search for Windows 10 client setup keys, it'll give you a table. Copy that key, paste it into here, save that, and that will transform a Pro device into Enterprise. And when it boots back up in Enterprise, it'll seek out a KMS server and activate from there. We can also apply various security policies. So if we expand out policies, we can configure accounts, we can lock out Bluetooth, we can do all kinds of different settings that are very similar to what you could do via MDM, not surprisingly, because this builds right on top of the MDM stack. When we've configured everything we want, we can then just say we want to export this as a provisioning package. We give it a name, a version number, we can encrypt it if we want, we can sign it if we want, and that becomes the provisioning package that you then have to figure out how to get it to the device.
Some of the commercially bought computers have software on them which you might not want to be on there after this. Can you remove that?
There's the number one challenge. The comment was, a lot of PCs, when you buy them, have a lot of extra bloatware on them. Can you remove that? With the original release of the imaging and configuration designer, there was no way at all, because there was no way of running arbitrary commands or scripts or anything like that. With the release that's coming out very soon, well, it's already published on the download center, there's just no link that points to it yet, but that version adds the ability to run command lines. That's only halfway solving the problem, because then you had to figure out, well, what are the uninstall commands to remove that stuff, which is a never-ending battle, because every OEM, every model, every PC potentially could have something different on it. So that's still a challenge, getting rid of that stuff, figuring out what you want to get rid of and what you need to leave behind, because things like demo versions of security software you probably want to remove, but apps that are designed to support the hardware, those you probably want to leave. So that is going to take a fair amount of work if you want to truly clean off the machine. We are seeing OEMs offer the ability to ship you a machine that doesn't have that. The Microsoft Store does that for every machine that they sell, which is great. So go down to Sydney, buy a PC there. Or Dell and other OEMs will ship you a PC without that stuff on it as well. I mean, generally, they charge a little extra, like for $10, they'll remove that stuff from the PC. That's about how much money they make from that software that's pre-installed on the device. So if you pay them, they'll get rid of it. So there are some options like that. But you do have the ability, at least now, to, if we look through here, there's the ability to run arbitrary commands through provisioning commands. So you can specify whatever command line you want and any content you want that goes along with that. It'll bundle it all up into the provisioning package and run it for you. Okay. Traditional deployment then. We've released a new ADK, we released a new MDT, we updated Config Manager. All of it's fairly minor, though, just to add support for Windows 10 and the latest capabilities there. So the process itself hasn't changed any. If you look at a Windows 7 deployment task sequence and compare it against a Windows 10 task sequence, you won't be able to tell the difference between them. So as a result, it would be fairly natural to deploy Windows 10. It'll be exactly the same way as you're deploying Windows 7 today. That's a good thing. From a compatibility perspective, any device capable of running Windows 7, 8, or 8.1 will run Windows 10 without any issue. Desktop apps, the compatibility rates that we're seeing are extremely good. Not perfect, because developers always do stupid things, but a high 90% of applications should work on Windows 10 without any issues. We've had customers that have tested all 3,000 of their applications and told us they found 3 that had issues. That's the type of success rate that we want to see. We want to know that when you install Windows 10, that your apps are just going to work. Same with store apps. We test those all the time because we have copies of them in the store, so no compatibility issues there. And then that leaves us with IE. We solve that particular problem with enterprise mode and IE 11, which we talked about earlier. So that's kind of the first step. How do we deploy Windows 10 to a machine running Windows 7, Windows 8, or Windows 8.1? The next step then is how do we keep it up to date after that? And that becomes an interesting process because what we're doing now is releasing new capabilities 2 to 3 times per year. Starting off internally, we create a new build of Windows every day. We can then deploy that out within Microsoft a few times a week. Eventually, we see builds that we think are good enough for public consumption. Those go out to the Insider Preview. How many of you have signed up for the Insider Preview? It will never end if there are various points where you can jump off and continue to run the released version, but we will constantly be doing this. We'll come out with new releases of Insider Preview builds starting next month. Not that we really need to wait that long, but there are holidays coming up in the U.S., so a lot of people are going on vacation. As a result, they don't want to rush and get a build out there, but probably in early December, you'll start seeing new Insider builds with more new features. So we're constantly going through this cycle over a period of 4 to 6 months, releasing new Insider Preview builds with the latest and greatest, probably once every other week on average. Eventually, we then get to a point where we say, this is good enough to ship. It has the functionality we want. It has the stability we want. We deploy it out. And as a result, we can go out to the current branch and hit hundreds of millions of machines, starting with consumer devices primarily. You, though, may not want to deploy a new version of Windows a day after it's been released. Okay, a lot of you are a little too conservative. That's just too fast for you. So we have created this current branch for business where we can delay 4 months before we do a deployment. But we don't want to stop there. We want to give you the flexibility also to create your own rings inside of that and then do a staged deployment throughout your organization. So do a group of early adopters primarily on the current branch and then go through different rings or groups of machines after that. So we want to get to this new approach of deploying these new capabilities. The challenge is if you're upgrading Windows 2 to 3 times per year with new capabilities, you can't possibly test all of your applications 2 to 3 times per year. So you need to be able to, well, to a certain extent, trust us, but also focus on what's really important. Identify the apps that are critical, test out those critical applications, and then react for all the other applications to any issues that might crop up. Now, that's going to take some getting used to really feel comfortable with only testing a small percentage of your applications, and then leveraging pilot groups and early rings to do the validation of the rest of the environment. Once we do something like that, we get to a situation where we're not doing the traditional big deployment process, where we spend huge amounts of money to get our infrastructure up to date, to build new images, to do all the engineering around that, and then do the deployment. We want to move away from that every 2 to 3 year process to more of a continual deployment cycle, where we test what's critical 2 to 3 times per year, and then do a ring-based deployment from there. So we spread out the costs over a period of years. If we total up those smaller costs, hopefully it's still less than what you would have spent on those larger deployments. We'll prove that out over time, but the goal is that since we spend a lot less on engineering effort and a lot less on application testing, which are the two biggest portions of expenses, that will reduce the costs overall. Yeah, so there are some challenges around the size of the deployments and the amount of bandwidth that's being consumed. So yeah, that's definitely a concern, but it's something that we're working on. We do want to shrink these over time. So if we look at deployment strategy then, we want all organizations to be involved in the Insider Preview to test out new features and functions as they're being developed, then use the current branch for deployments. doing your initial pilots, doing your initial tests within your environment to see how well this version is going to work, before doing broad deployments of significant percentages of your organization using the current branch for business. We do know, though, that there are some machines that are special. These specialty systems require something else. So we have this long-term servicing branch release of Windows as well, which is more traditional. We'll release a new version of Windows and support it for 10 years with no new features. We'll continue to patch it every month with new security updates and bug fixes, but we won't add any new fixes. We'll release new ones of these every 2 years or so, but we won't touch the existing functionality, which gives you the flexibility then to migrate whenever you want. We will have the ability to configure machines, whether they should get the updates right away or should they get the new feature upgrades later. So you can choose to defer them automatically by 4 months just by setting a single policy, either manually or via GPO. That puts you onto the current branch for business. If you look at the LTSB release, you really have to think about this one, though, because there are things that we remove from the LTSB release of Windows 10. We get rid of Edge, we get rid of Cortana, we get rid of the Windows Store, so you're left with an operating system that doesn't contain any of the inbox applications because they're updated frequently. Because they're updated frequently, they add new features frequently, that makes them incompatible with the idea of a long-term servicing branch. So we strip all of that out, we ship separate media for these, and we don't have as much to worry about then because we have all these extra things removed. So the deployment cycle you typically go through then is you're doing your initial evaluation using the insider preview. You then do piloting using the current branch, and then broad deployment using the current branch for business. That cycle repeats itself and stacks on top of each other. So when you start looking at this, you're constantly evaluating something, you're constantly piloting something, you're constantly deploying something in this never-ending cycle. We want to make sure that we support at least 2 CBB releases, current branch for business releases at all times. So you can see when that third one comes out, we stop supporting the first one and stop releasing security updates for that first one. So if you have deployed the first one, by the time the third one's released, you better at least be on the second one. Customers then look at it and say, well, can I skip one? And maybe you could skip from the first one in the green bar to the second one in the yellow bar. But if you wanted to wait until the last moment and then upgrade every single machine to the latest release in one day, that's pretty risky. When we talk about how to keep them up to date, we want to provide options as well. So we're working on supporting this via Windows Update. So machines running pretty much every SKU but Enterprise today will be able to get feature upgrades from Windows Update directly. We're working on getting that for Enterprise as well. We'll also have Windows Update for Business, which is all about defining your own internal rings for doing a staged deployment. So you could say this group of machines gets deployed right away, this one's delayed by a month, this one's delayed by 2 months, this one's delayed by 3 months, and then kind of put it on autopilot. So as these new feature releases come out, they get deployed to each group of machines as it happens. Same thing with WSUS. You can use WSUS to create your own computer groups and target by computer group. There's a little bit more manual activity required there because you can set up an automatic approval rule for the first group, but then you would have to manually approve the subsequent groups. The same would be the case with Config Manager. You could create Config Manager collections of machines for these different groups and then target updates to each group at different points in time. But that would require manually going in and approving for each of those groups. So with Config Manager vNext, they're adding functionality to let you set up the rules to say every time a new feature upgrade comes out, deploy it automatically on day 0 to this group, deploy it on day 30 to this group, deploy it on day 60 to this group. So it gives you the flexibility of doing that phased deployment there as well. We can configure, in the case of Windows Update for Business, a simple GPO, where we just specify this GPO and say, here are the number of months that I want to defer. So you create policies then and target settings to the different groups based on how long you want to delay. So with that, I'm pretty much out of time. Are there any questions around Windows as a service in general, or anything else that we talked about? Sure.
For the full update of Windows 10, are you saying that if you've already built a lot of Windows 10 as it was released, with all the applications packaged in, are you saying now treat it almost like an 8.1 to 10 upgrade for the full update would be pretty
good? Yeah, that's a fair comparison. The comment was, well, let's say we already deployed Windows 10, the July release. Now the November release is out. Is that going to be a full in-place upgrade just like we would have done from Windows 8 to Windows 8.1? Yes. In fact, it's the exact same process you would see to go from one insider build to the next insider build. So it's the exact same in-place upgrade being used for that. No, because you can't sysprep an upgraded OS. So you'd have to build a new image with the 1511 media. If there are any other questions, come up front and find me. I'll try to address any questions you have. Otherwise, thanks for attending.